on This Week in Enterprise Tech. It only costs $225 at a Raspberry Pi to spoof your GPS signal. Cisco is back in the news with more network backdoors, and Brian Kernis and I talk with an expert, Tim Titus, CTO of Past Solutions, around natural language troubleshooting. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 300, recorded July 20th, 2018, Natural Language Troubleshooting. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by MOOCsoft. Reduce IT alerts and tickets by up to 90%. Guaranteed. Visit MOOCsoft.com to learn more and sign up for a demo. And by LastPass. Secure every password-protected entry point to your business. Join over 33,000 businesses and start managing and securing your company's passwords today. Learn more at LastPass.com/TWiT. Welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the IT pro, the enterprise professional, the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I am your host, Louis Moresco, your guide to the world of enterprise. And folks, it is episode 300. And not only are we going to take the celebration to a great new level, but also we're going to have some cake, and we're going to also have an all-star cast on the show today, starting with our very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. Curtis, you're getting ready for Black Hat and DEF CON, aren't you?
I am indeed. I'm going to be heading out there early in August, making my plans now. And I have so far, I think, 479 different requests for interviews out there. So it's going to be a jam-packed week, but should be a lot of fun.
Oh, you're going to be busy. That's going to be fun, though. I think I'm still trying to get there. We'll see what happens, hopefully, in the next couple of weeks. Of course, we definitely don't want to do the show without Mr. Brian Chi, Director of Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu. Chibert, welcome back. It sounds like you have some cool new toys you're playing with there.
Yeah. We're trying to take IoT to another level. We're measuring the temperatures of our neg 100 Celsius freezers. And I'm also going to be measuring the current so we can predict when the compressors start going bad so that we can preserve genetic material and not have it all go bad, which could stink for a lot of people. But it's nice because I'm using a combination of Atlas Scientific and Cayenne by My Devices, which were a guest on a show previously.
Fantastic. Well, folks, we have a pretty jam-packed episode today. And not only is it 300th episode, but we also have a pretty great guest, Mr. Tim Titus, to come talk to us a little about natural language troubleshooting. But of course, we have so much content, we better get right into it. And so let's start up with getting into the blips. So you remember hearing about Google being fined 4.3 billion euros or $5.3 billion for antitrust violations from the EU. Remember that? Well, they were fined for things like bundling certain apps with Android. But the largest infraction was due to what they call illegal tying. Of course, it is what they're doing is bundling both search and browser apps to the Android operating system. Now, Google required Android manufacturers to install Google Search and their browser in order to provide access to the Google Play Store to their users. Well, this reduces the ability for search and browser companies to compete, creating a what they call status quo bias. But the interesting thing here is the European Commission has decided to go after Google, but not Apple for the same reasons. Now, consumers are not happy with this. The commission ruled that bundling practices were illegal because of Google's dominance in the markets of what they call licensable smart mobile operating system and app stores for Android mobile operating systems. The language matters because Apple or BlackBerry don't license its operating system to equipment manufacturers. It produces a full package, and it cannot be accused of putting illegal pressure on manufacturers. So it seems that the closed ecosystem that Apple's created has somehow also protected them from the EU as well for now. Now, this brings up a bunch of other questions around the fact that Google is being punished for offering an open platform, but they're trying to get more exposure for using it. And also seems that consumers and developers alike will soon be the only voice that will make an impact on these platforms just after the EU gets their piece of the pie.
Hey, you want to score some coin? Just find the right bugs in Microsoft products. A new Microsoft bug bounty program asks researchers to hunt down vulnerabilities affecting its identity services in exchange for rewards ranging from $500 to $100,000. Researchers who participate in the identity bounty program will submit flaws they discover in Microsoft's consumer and Azure Active Directory identity solutions and certified implementations of select OpenID standards, the company said. In order to be eligible for payouts, vulnerabilities must be original, previously unreported, lead to the takeover of a Microsoft account or Azure AD account, include the impact and attack vector, and detail the steps to reproduce the flaw. Payouts start at $500 for incomplete submissions related to cross-site request forgery, authorization flaws, or sensitive data exposure. High-quality submissions for multi-factor authentication bypass or standards design vulnerabilities can lead to $100,000 payouts. Now, there are several types of reports that don't count as part of the bounty program, and the range of ineligible reports can be found on the Microsoft Security Response Center site.
Well, Project Loon signed its first deal for internet delivering balloons in Kenya. Project Loon, the internet delivering balloon system that grew out of Alphabet's Project X division, has announced its first commercial deal. According to multiple reports, the recent Project X graduates will partner with Telecom Kenya to increase connectivity in the country. Quote, connectivity is critical. If you're not online, you're left out, Joe Maturo, Kenya's Information Communication Technology Minister, told Reuters. Loon is another technology that is being introduced that the licensed operators hopefully can be able to use. Well, with this first commercial proof of concept kicking off, this could go a long way to helping close the digital divide in internet-poor countries for the first time.
Nowadays, it seems that all pieces of hardware eventually expose a weakness in their security. Now, adversaries are getting smarter and craftier, forcing companies to do better things around their devices, making sure they're staying up to date. But for Cisco, there has been an interesting trajectory of increased exposure over the past years. Back in 2004, Cisco wrote a proposal around a lawful intercept backdoor for routers, which allowed law enforcement to actually use or remotely log into those routers. Many years later, in 2010, IBM security researchers actually showed this protocol could be used by malicious attackers to take over Cisco iOS routers used by large ISPs and enterprises. Then again, in 2013, 2014, 2015, and 2017, a bunch of other undocumented backdoors popped up for Cisco networking equipment, including the NSA taking advantage of certain backdoors in Cisco routers, attackers accessing user credentials, issuing arbitrary commands with escalated privileges, and state sponsor actors using backdoors for admin privileges, and of course the CIA remotely commanding over 300 Cisco switch models via a hardware vulnerability. Now, this might not sound that bad spanning over many years. It seems to me that the more popular hardware and software come today, the more exploit attempts on it. But that seems to be the formula nowadays. Now, well, the interesting thing about this is in the last 5 months, five new backdoors in just 5 months. Starting in March, with a hard-coded account username issue, Cisco was revealed, allowing for 8.5 million routers to be exposed. And that same month, another hard-coded password was found in the Cisco PCP software. And in May, Cisco found another backdoor account in Cisco's Digital Architecture Center. Then in June, another one was found in their Wide Area App Services software tool, and the most recent being a backdoor in the Cisco's policy suite, which is used to manage bandwidth policies. Now, it sounds like to me Cisco needs to start up their own task force here in order to put a stop to the madness before sales and it actually starts affecting sales and the trust issues make a big impact. Good luck, Cisco.
Hey, there's a new subscription that's helping protect companies from ransomware. The Flashpoint Threat Response and Readiness subscription includes training on what to do when a ransomware or extortion attack hits, and negotiated rates for professional services when an attack actually occurs. Attacks based on extortion, when a threat actor exfiltrates information and threatens to reveal the contents if money's not paid, fall outside the playbook of most organizations. And it's a playbook that has pages covering more than the IT security organization, with legal departments, outside counsel, and the PR team, among others, becoming involved. Now, this is where cyber blends with the business, with that blending coming with a whack of stress because all the teams are going to be in full incident response mode. And that's typically a very poor time to be developing policies and processes to deal with an issue. The subscription is intended to help companies understand the malware, understand the options for responding, and decide whether there's a cyber response in addition to that all-important business response.
Well, Windows 10 is going to get better at telling time, and Microsoft is touting the new Leap Second support. I'm going to go in off in a little slightly different direction, but the next big update for Windows 10 is due out in October, and the next version of Windows Server is going to be called Windows Server 2019. Both will include support for leap seconds and so forth. But what is the foundation for this is a new, well, relatively new, it's about a decade old, protocol that's going to replace the venerable network time protocol. So NTP is cool. It does some adjustments for when you, the delay and latency between the time source and you. But the precision time protocol is going to slowly move, you know, make the option available. Now, the cool thing about precision time, its other name is IEEE 1588, has been used for a very long time within the manufacturing world. In fact, if you're visiting a factory that has robot arms, say building a car or an appliance or something like that, almost guaranteed those network switches connecting them together are using IEEE 1588 precision time protocol so that they can have accuracy within 100 nanoseconds. Now, I should point out that the scientists have glommed onto this. In fact, I'm a big user of IEEE 1588 switches. We actually extend precision time protocol down underwater. And so right now we're running the 100 nanosecond version, sorry, nanosecond, not microsecond, and allows us to synchronize all our instruments together, especially hydrophones, seismometers, and so forth, so that when we have our observations, we can synchronize them together nicely. Same thing in the factories. In fact, Tesla has a whole bunch of them. Previously, not many manufacturers provided this support. Cisco, Hirschmann, and so forth are some of the big ones, and those switches are insanely expensive. Now, what's nice about this is by having the process and automation scientific investigations of PTP available at both the workstation and the server, it means we can start having the timestamps and all these other things that we record data on being much, much more accurate. So while Microsoft is doing this because of demands by the U.S. federal government requiring this ultra-precise clock, it's going to really be a big deal for the science and industry folks. And I'm really looking forward to having these super accurate clocks so that maybe, just maybe, we can start doing some really interesting things like synchronizing underwater devices so we can actually measure, you know, underwater earthquake slippage and things like that. So anyway, it's an interesting development, and I applaud Microsoft for doing something that's going to not only benefit their sales to federal government, but also for the science and industrial industries.
Now, our audience is fairly familiar with PowerShell. We talked about it a bunch in the past episodes, and being that it's an open source task-based command line shell and scripting language, it makes it easier for people to manage their hybrid cloud assets. Now, back in 2016, it came as a shock when PowerShell actually went open source and started being readily available for both Windows, Linux, and Mac. Now, for Linux, installing PowerShell was a bit cumbersome, and it wasn't always easy to update. Now, other Linux applications today and systems use what they call snaps these days in order to isolate and stay up to date. Now, snaps are containerized software packages designed to work across cloud, desktop, and IoT devices. They work natively on most popular Linux distributions, and they feature automatic updates for users, enhanced security, and greater flexibility for developers working on Linux environments. Well, surprise, this week Microsoft announced that PowerShell Core is now available for Linux as a snap. Now, if you are a PowerShell believer and a user, your knowledge is basically reusable or numerous platforms. And now Linux admins can ensure things are staying up to date and secure and productive. Being a fan of PowerShell, all I can say is, go PowerShell. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But first, we have to thank a pretty great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's MOOCsoft. Now, being an engineer in the business in both ops and as a developer, I'll tell you one thing. It's really hard to manage all of those tickets that are coming in, all those different alerts that are coming in over the wire. Operations would get an alert. They create a ticket for engineering. Engineering looks into it, but then another alert comes in. Another engineering team gets a ticket. And all the while, customers are suffering, and they're calling into support, creating new tickets and new alerts. Now, that becomes much really hard to manage, and that's kind of where MOOCsoft AIOps comes into play. It's artificial intelligence for IT operations. They have a patented noise reduction technology as well as automatic deduplication and alert ranking. There's no rules or filters. They manage the flood of alerts for you. They can literally reduce your alerts by 90%. Now, once the alerts are managed, they also serve as actionable work items for you. Their clustering technology even correlates the situations for better view, as well as MOOCsoft does this because it looks at the patterns in order to provide root cause for any incoming situation. Now, it can even reuse what they call tribal knowledge, of course, and automatically help resolve issues quickly by using supervised machine learning. And not only that, it integrates with just about everything. Node.js, AppDynamics, Splunk, AWS, Azure tools, and more. And it's extensible, which means you can easily integrate your system into it because it uses standard mechanisms like REST and webhooks and SMP. Now, plug your data into it and get working, because MOOCsoft is really that one-stop shop for IT and dev organizations, because it analyzes, manages, and routes the fire hose alerts to make it more manageable. Now, this type of system is really a gift if you think about it, because it makes it so small and large organizations can scale their services and IT business. Now, it makes it so you can achieve full visibility across your entire technology stack without any blind spots. Now, not that you needed any more proof, but you have heard of that global IT managed service provider, HCL Technologies. They include AIOps in their award-winning dry ice platform within their event management layer. Now, not only does this help the organization reduce ops workflow, but it also helped reduce detect to correct time throughout the lifetime of the ticket. Now, how well does this help HCL? Well, it actually helped reduce their mean time to restore by 33%. What does that mean? Well, it means that they can support more customers with higher service quality, all the while also keeping their operating system operating costs low and their efficiency high. Now, I don't know about you, but if you're an organization with a service or even an app out there today, you're going to want MOOCsoft AIOps to scale your business. With MOOCsoft AIOps, you can reduce your IT alerts and tickets by up to 90% guaranteed. Visit MOOCsoft.com to get a demo. That's MOOCsoft.com. And we thank MOOCsoft for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's time to get into the bites, and we have a doozy here today. We're talking a little bit about GPS spoofing. Now, we all kind of rely on GPS. I use it every day. Waze is one of my favorite applications to go through traffic and get directions. But if you're a developer, like for instance for Android or for mobile platform, you're fairly familiar with what we call GPS spoofing, because that allows you to essentially change your location on demand for the device, so that the application or the code that you're writing can go run and test on it. So you basically spoof your location, change it, and then the app kind of goes into text and you can run tests that way. But normally that doesn't really, it's not easily done for consumer devices or even commercial devices, because obviously these things are a little bit more harder to kind of get into and break open. Well, back in 2013, University of Texas built a $2,000 box that could actually spoof a GPS signal aboard an $80 million yacht. Now, the reason this worked was because GPS signals are sent from satellites to Earth without any authentication or encryption. Now, it was only a matter of time this was going to be exploited and more readily available. So Virginia Tech, China's University of Electronic Science and Technology, and Microsoft Research recently wrote an 18-page paper talking about doing the same thing for only $225. Essentially, they just used a Raspberry Pi and a hack RF 1SDR, which is basically a software-defined radio peripheral, and in order to simulate a GPS signal. Now, the researchers tested a simulation of their attack against real cars and found it works best in cities where road networks are dense. This way, it doesn't tip off the actual consumer or the user of it that they're actually spoofing it. Now, it basically uses algorithms to plot a fake ghost route that mimics the turn-by-turn navigation directions contained in the original route. Now, this is bad. This means that now it's much cheaper to exploit GPS, which opens a whole big door of issues that can go along with both commercial and consumer devices alike. So I want to send it over to you first, Jeebert. This is something that, you know, vendors are assuming that GPS is, you know, their thing, their go-to thing. I mean, is this going to be meaning that we're going to have to go and change the protocol now and actually implement something more secure? Because, you know, there's no way to kind of depend on it anymore.
Yeah, it's worrisome. One of the things that I was on a grant program working on what's called food security. You know, we all want to trust our food and the way the food gets to it. So what happens if a 40-foot Connex container of food gets purposely diverted because, you know, the driver thinks, oh, there's a big traffic jam going on or something, and you spoof GPS and it goes off and either someone goes and, you know, makes it come in really late or something. But anyway, the whole idea is there's a level of trust that people and developers have given to GPS. And what this is doing is saying, hey, we've got to start doing something more. So one of the things that were discussed in a group of scientists is, well, there's already terrestrial-based systems where you combine GPS to get you into the ballpark and then you use terrestrial radio signals to increase the accuracy. And one of the article goes on to say maybe the system should also go and use video, you know, pictures of the area so they can start comparing it. So with Waze and all these others that use roadway maps, they could compare what the intersections look like and kind of ground truth it all. But you know, the whole idea is this has gotten a lot cheaper. And what the article says, well, you know, because it's so small, it's easy to know. You could put higher gain antennas and amplifiers on way, way cheap. And all of a sudden, now you can have a signal that's dramatically more powerful than a satellite. So it's very worrisome. I'd love to see a little bit more done, especially when we start getting into autonomous vehicles. It's something that needs to be done, and we're going to have more research, and maybe just maybe those GPS satellites have to have maybe some digital signatures on them or so we know if we can trust the signal. What do you think?
Right. Yeah, I agree. I think that, you know, at this point, if you're going to have to go change the protocol, you have thousands of satellites that are supporting GPS today. They're going to have either software updates, hopefully not hardware updates. I mean, this is going to be an expensive thing moving forward, especially if organizations are going to depend on it. Now, we have seen this in the past, right, Curtis? I think you kind of pointed out this has been an exploit in the past, but it was less attainable by other than maybe government actors at that point. Now we're saying, hey, it's easier to get in the consumer side. I mean, what kind of exploit was this before? Was this big? Was this small? Was this dangerous? What kind of things were they exploiting?
Well, last year at roughly this time, it was last August, there was a massive GPS spoofing attack that happened in the Baltic. And it was pretty dangerous because all of a sudden ships that were getting ready to enter a harbor found their GPS navigation screens showing that they were about 50 miles inland. So this was something where they could look out the bridge window and see that they were getting bad information. But all of a sudden, this navigational tool that they had been using was off, and not off by a few meters, but off by tens of miles. Now, at the time, there was great speculation that this was something being done by the Russian government because they basically didn't want people to be able to track Vladimir Putin's location easily because there was some correlation between his known location and where some of these spoofs happened. And they happened two or three times. Then they went away largely because there was such an outcry and people knew that they were going on. The thing is, as you said, at that time, this was a major, major operation because this was overwhelming commercial systems covering a radius of tens of miles in terms of its effect. What we're seeing here with this new device is something that would have a much smaller range, but could theoretically affect many more devices if it were deployed, say, in a city center. So we absolutely positively have become used to GPS for a whole variety of reasons. And if it's not trustworthy anymore, then it's a huge, huge problem. Now, the government has done research on what to do if it's disabled in time of say, war or conflict, but degraded because of a cyber attack or a ransomware attack, that's something that no one has really wanted to deal with up to now.
Right. And the interesting thing is it's cheap. I mean, the Raspberry Pi, obviously, we've worked with it before. Obviously, a mobile charger and antenna. And of course, then they have this called HackRF or 1SDR, which is a software-defined radio peripheral, which transmits the reception of radio signals from 1 megahertz to 6 gigahertz. And that allows you to essentially be used with USB peripheral and programmed for standalone operation. So it's something that's readily available. You can go get it at Adafruit or whatever and pick it up, build this thing, and get moving. I think, Cheebert, I mean, this makes it scary, right? Because now we're saying, hey, you know, we might have to start securing, just as Curtis said, we might have to start securing endpoints here, especially if you're dependent on it. I've seen tons of field service operations and commercial software to handle, like, you know, servicing trucks, and, you know, there's delivery trucks and delivery services that'll be affected here. You know, obviously I can think of at least 10 ways to exploit this to be able to steal things. So I think this becomes kind of a big thing. If it's this readily available, you're going to get hackers just trying this out going forward. Is it something that organizations are going to have to worry about now?
Yeah. You know, like, for instance, one of the examples I came up with was armored car companies are now starting to use, well, have started to use GPS so that the internal lockboxes within the armored car were not able to be opened unless you're within a certain radius of the delivery location, just to make it harder for someone to steal the contents of armored cars. So if you can spoof it, all of a sudden now you can open those lock boxes. That's not a good thing. And I'm sure people like Tiffany's and so forth are quaking in their boots.
Right. Well, interesting thing, I actually saw, you know, there was a quick demo of this that we saw. They have a little demo link. And the interesting thing is, you know, you have to be fairly close because they're not as powerful as Curtis is saying, some of these other ones in the past. So you do have to get fairly close. And also the interesting thing about the exploit that they showed was it's kind of even though it's a back door, it makes it kind of look like they have to trick even the user of it to think, hey, like, we're going in the same direction, but, you know, tricking them by making the directions complex so they don't realize they're actually going in a different direction. But it sounds like to me that this is going to be something that's going to be moving forward, that organizations are going to have to pay more attention to when they're building software. I mean, I'm seeing just a quick search, Curtis. I think I'm seeing just even simple new startups out there showing simple services that are depending on GPS, like, for instance, your field service management software, your packaging software, your delivery software. You know, everything is kind of depending on this. And then, of course, all the consumer devices out there. You know, where do we go from here? Like, where do you think we should go from here at this point, especially from an enterprise perspective?
Well, I think that there are several things to do, but the unfortunate piece of this is that virtually none of the steps that can be taken by the consumer. This is not like most GPS units are field upgradable. Virtually none of them are consumer upgradable. So these are the sorts of things that are going to have to be done at the manufacturer and at the satellite operator stage. So until then, I think the advice comes with, let's just go ahead and look out the window. Do a field check. Make sure that your experience matches the GPS and show a little common sense and an awful lot of paranoia.
Right. You would think you wouldn't have to do that, but in this day and age. But obviously, use a little common sense. Absolutely. Well, folks, that does it for the Bytes. Next up, my favorite part of the show, we bring an expert in to talk to the Twilight Riot. But first, we have to thank another sponsor in This Week Enterprise Tech, and that's LastPass. Now, I use LastPass every day. And it, you know, not only do I use it so often, I don't even know I'm using it anymore. It's one of my favorite tools. You have a username and password for every site you go to. For me, it's five different banks. I actually have to use a different username and password for every bank because I want to make sure it's secure. And it's really impossible to remember those things. I mean, you have so many different ones. You don't want to stick it on a sticky note or on some plain text on your devices because that's just not a good idea. It's a bad idea. It's less secure. Well, that's where LastPass comes in. It saves us all. LastPass automatically remembers and fills in your passwords anytime, anywhere, whether you're on a computer or a mobile device. All you have to do is remember your master password, and LastPass remembers the rest. Now, I got hooked on it when I started using it on the desktop, but now that it's so useful, I started using it on all my devices. They even have browser add-ins to make it easier for you to log in, supporting both also Chrome, Edge, Firefox, Opera, and more. Plus, it works great on Android and iOS. Now, I remember a day I was called at work by my family. They said, hey, we need that password for the bank account in order to make a payment. Did I remember it? Well, of course not. Five different banks. So all I had to do is visit the LastPass vault, use my one and only master password, and bam, I could give them that password and they pay those bills. Now, LastPass has literally saved me time and money. Now, I'm talking about my personal account with LastPass, but they also have LastPass families for the entire family, and LastPass also works amazing for enterprise too. Now, enterprises always are battling people trying to breach their networks. In fact, over 81% of breaches are caused by weak or reused passwords. Now, LastPass makes it easy to use unique random passwords that your employees don't have to remember or write down. Plus, password sharing is hard, and LastPass makes it easy for your org to share those passwords. Now, organizations can set a master password and requirements and restrictions in order to access specific devices and locations and enable password resets and more. Now, you can also configure over 100 different policies and access security reports and create shared folders. Now, you can secure a ton of stuff, including organized database logins, SSH keys, software licenses, and other important business information. Now, data is encrypted and decrypted at the device level, and data is stored in the vault and is kept secret even from LastPass. Now, you and your employees can take the LastPass security challenge. It'll tell you how secure your passwords are, and it will show you areas of improvement. This is a great tool. Again, I'm a LastPass user for life. I love using it. It makes my life a lot easier, to save a lot of time. Just remember, at work and at home, fix your password woes with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit today. That's lastpass.com/twit, and see what product is right for you. And we thanks LastPass for their support in This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's time to get to my favorite part of the show. That's bringing a guest in to drop some knowledge on the Twilight. And of course, no exception today. It's Mr. Tim Titus, CTO of Pass Solutions. Tim, you're in studio for our 300th episode. Welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. I was here for 200 and it was a lot of fun. I figured I got invited back for 300. I think you guys only invite me because I bring cake. Isn't that the reason?
No, I don't think so. I think it's just because you're the network geek of geeks. I think that's why we keep bringing you back.
Welcome. I'm an old hat network geek. I'm hiding the gray hair.
It's a
really
layered thing. It's a layered thing, yeah. Fantastic. Well, welcome back. We have a great bunch of great topics to talk about today. Of course, the third 300th episode. And of course, one being network automation. And of course, some of the topics that we're going to talk about today, what you'll notice is there's some points that kind of go in the same direction. One being that there's more and more devices, more and more people on the earth, and it creates for more and more complexity in our networks. And we have to find ways to kind of cut through that complexity. Now, some of the topics today are talking about a little bit about Cisco DNA and Cisco ACI. Can you just give me the folks at home a little bit of summary of what those are and what they kind of help you do, what kind of organizations help they do?
So Cisco DNA, so I was out at Cisco Live just, it feels like a couple of weeks ago, but I think it was actually a month ago. And fantastic show. Big thing that was really being talked about a lot was Cisco DNA Center. And for folks that don't know what DNA Center is, it's actually a really cool piece of technology that I figure it's definitely one of those pieces of tech that's going to have some legs. What it allows you to do is to dynamically change the configuration and operation of your network, either at a push of a button, or you can schedule to have your network changed. Now, what this really means from a business side is, imagine if you had a school system, a grade school, that had, during the day, you had students that would connect to their educational servers, they would connect to Scholastic servers, but after hours, they rent the classroom out to, let's say, an AA meeting. And the AA meeting says, we need internet connectivity, and yet you don't want them on the same network as the rest of your servers. And you're thinking, well, normally you just figure put them on an outside network. But actually, you need to do some firewall changes because the AA meeting is going to look at how the alcohol industry advertises. And so they're going to want to visit some websites to show that sort of stuff. Yet this is normally blocked at a grade school. So your network actually has to reconfigure for the different business need. And then in the morning, reconfigure back to the normal business need. Other examples would be a stadium where at noon you have a football game going on, but at 8 p.m. you have one of the biggest rock stars come in, and that network has to change for the purpose of what is being presented in that stadium. So really neat technology as far as being able to just change the network almost at whim, which I think is going to support a lot of businesses where they say, gee, we need a different network and we need that different network almost overnight. They can make those sort of changes very dynamically.
So Tim, this is sounding like just a relabeled software-defined network. Well, you know, did the presentations go into what makes it different? And why would an enterprise want this if your network, you think, doesn't change that often?
Well, I think that's the thing that at least I've learned from business is if you're in business, things change and they change faster than you're usually prepared for it. There's many situations where all of a sudden your business says, gee, we need to have a different business unit operating here, or we're acquiring another company and that company needs to come into the fold and be operational within a couple of weeks, not a couple of months, but a couple of weeks. Being able to have a network that changes as fast as the business needs change is really something that I think they were very advanced in their thinking of how to do this. Now, you're right. You're questioning, is this SDN? I would say this is probably the most accurate representation of SDN that at least I believe I've seen. I think over the past years, we've seen a number of different companies say, hey, we're doing SDN, and this is what we believe SDN is. And other companies say, oh, we think SDN is something different. I think this is the first time SDN has been properly defined of a network that will dynamically change to what the needs of the users and the business are as the needs change, instead of just, well, we're going to change routing. It's, you know, what their DNA center does is it will change routing, it will change policies, it will change security, it will change access lists, it will change QoS. So effectively, being able to make any change to the network according to whatever schedule you want, I see that as just, this is really what the industry has been asking for with SDN, and I think Cisco's really nailed it with that definition.
Tim, I've got to ask, when you're talking about doing this with definitions, when you're talking about changing the network at the speed of business, over the past decade, 15 years even, we've heard about more and more things changing at the speed of business. But there's always been something, and it, to this point, it's generally been the network that was sort of a point of stability around which everything else could change. Do you think that with this kind of option being available, we're out of stability points, or is there something else now around which the business needs can revolve, or do we just have to get used to living in a totally unmoored, all changing, many different moving parts kind of environment?
Well, I think it's that you have, I guess I'm going to describe what they've done as, you can have a large room that has a number of different people using that room at the same time versus, I know everyone has been in a multi-purpose room. Usually this is in a school. You're in a multi-purpose room that they can reconfigure the room to have stadium seating. They can reconfigure the room to say, we're going to have a small stage. We're going to reconfigure the room to have it be a giant circle time where everyone sits in a circle and can meet. Or we'll put gymnastics in here. And I think that's really their take on the network. And you're right. It used to be just one stable, static environment where it works. Now, is DNA Center going to make it so that you have the flexibility? Yes. Is it going to create some strange situations that lose some of the stability? I would also say yes. And the reason is this is very new technology. You're going to have the system, and I don't mean to diss their technology, but you are going to have situations where people will put a change into place and they're not aware of the effect of the change. And so they figure at 8 p.m. when the classroom changes to support the AA meetings, they're realizing, gee, it didn't change, and so those people can't connect to the network, or it didn't effectively allow them access to their servers or their services. Or you come in the morning and you find some grade school kid that says, ha, look, I can go out and surf the internet and hit Budweiser's website. And so there's going to be some learning about how to make sure it is used effectively and that the bugs are worked out so that you don't have networks change and create problems as a result of either poor administration or it just being a very early on product.
Right. Now, the interesting thing is coming from Cisco Live, do you feel like you've gotten some feedback from attendees and others around, you know, potential changes that are required in the system?
Well, so right now it's I think there's excitement about this technology, but there's still a lot of trepidation. And my guess is for organizations that have to deal with change on a daily basis, you'll have some larger organizations that say, we don't want to have 70 CCIEs working for our team modifying our network. We'd like to have a core team of 5 or 10 experts and give them the right tools that they can end up managing and directing and choreographing the network's operation that are going to benefit from this. And they're going to be forced into doing that. Medium-sized organizations are going to hold back and probably watch to see how well does this play out? What are the pitfalls? What are the benefits? And when it's financially viable, they'll jump in. But I think right now it's we're in early adopter mode.
Right. So what about existing solutions today? So there's obviously people are using existing solutions today, and now hearing a little bit more about DNA Center and some of the things that they're moving forward on, how does this change? Like what are people's frustrations with the current solutions, and why are they kind of moving on to DNA?
Well, again, the current problem is that you'll have organizations that say, I have a new office to open up. I have new VLANs that I need to assign. This network has to change. And what they'll use is they will use various configuration management tools. We actually have a configuration management tool that we're coming out with in 3 months. So that's going to be part of our package. So configuration management tools are kind of the first step that you need to be able to do those sort of wide-scale configuration implementations. The thing is, though, is that eventually you will get a network that is large enough that configuration change management is still going to be a little bit clumsy for those extremely large networks where you want to make policy changes, you want to make firewall changes, and all of that has to happen in one button press together rather than saying, I'm going to go out and make this change, this change, this change, and this change and hope that all of them take and they all match up. And so that's kind of where configuration change management eventually would be outgrown and you'd need something like DNA Center.
Hey, Tim. So it's I work on a medium-sized network, and the number of tools that I'm starting to have to gather just to do different things and make changes to the network and find out what's going on is starting to become overwhelming. You were mentioning in a brief email conversation that you're starting to get some feedback from your customers on when is enough too much. What kind of changes are you seeing in that industry?
So on the tool side, really – there's a giant pendulum swing that seems to swing back and forth. I mean, I think sadly all of us are old enough. We can remember there was a pendulum swing towards mainframes, and then you had desktops and client server. And then it swung back to light clients, and then it swung back to browsers. And we're kind of in this mode where we have some really powerful browsers. So everything I see in technology is this giant pendulum swing. And what ends up happening is, you used to have a lot of different tools, and then people swung over and said, I don't want a lot of different tools. I want one dashboard. The problem with the one dashboard is you're not seeing enough information, and so you're realizing you're blind. And so people go back and say, okay, let's keep one dashboard, one main tool, and then let's pepper around a few ancillary tools that are going to help solve problems. And even then, they're saying there's too many ancillary tools. The reason they end up with a lot of ancillary tools is the core part of their primary monitoring package isn't doing enough for them. So they end up needing to get 5 and 6 other tools around the sides just because they don't know enough of what's going on the network.
So, yeah, sorry. You know, I'm just saying. So one of the things that you wanted to talk about today was the changes to TotalView. How are you responding to these comments that you're getting off the show floor?
Well, so at Cisco Live, we did a lot of listening, and that's something I think that's core to any company that's trying to solve problems for engineers is find out what they're complaining about. What are the issues? And one of the things we keep hearing is people say, I have a monitoring solution, but it just doesn't do enough. It doesn't tell me about packet loss. It doesn't tell me why was my call quality bad 15 minutes ago. It doesn't tell me what's going on with my cloud services. There's just not enough visibility. And so we've taken that back. We got all of our elves working at top speed, and we came out with TotalView 9. And our product is completely revamped top to bottom with a completely new user interface. But we have a lot of major new features that we've added to this, like cloud monitoring. We have VoIP monitoring. We have call simulation. We have path mapping. We have diagramming. We have a correlation engine built in. And part of our point is that from what we've heard people saying, gee, I don't want to have to set up 6 different tools in my environment. I want one tool that has everything built in. That way they can go back to that one dashboard and see everything. And maybe if you need 1 or 2 other tools beside that, that's fine. But you're back to the more knowledge with one tool. And again, everything's a pendulum swing back and forth. But with more knowledge with one tool, you're going to solve problems faster because you're not having to go check this tool, then check the next tool, then check the next tool, and then mentally try and put it together.
So I think Jim, I was really curious. You know, we've been talking about the network, and in many ways, we're talking about the network as sort of a monolithic thing. And yet we know from everything that the industry is telling us that most organizations are going to what can be charitably described as a hybrid network, a hybrid environment where some of it is dealing with their on-premises equipment, some of it is dealing with cloud, some of it may be going to a colo. You have commodity internet. You may have different sorts of lease lines. When you hear about that hybrid environment, do we really have the tools available to reasonably manage that? Or do we have an awful lot of IT groups to horribly mix metaphors, both flying blind and working without a net?
Yeah. I'm going to be a little bold and say that, yes, I think the problem is solved today. And you know, I'm not aware of other competitors, but we do solve the problem. And part of it is that there's two issues there. And so, Curtis, what you mentioned is that you need visibility inside your environment as to what's going on in your domain of control, on your switches, on your routers. Are you dropping packets? Are you having QoS issues? Do you have cabling issues? Are you having any glitch, so, you know, spanning tree issues, whatever, in your infrastructure? And if you don't, that's good. But the problem is that you also need to validate what is the connectivity to Office 365? What is the connectivity to Salesforce? And so it's that second component of, do we have a healthy connection to these services? So being able to rule in and rule out both of those components is now critically important to today's environment. Because if you go up and say, gee, the problem's not in our network, your users don't care. They want you to solve the problem. They don't care where the problem is. They're just sitting there tapping their feet saying, I don't care. You need to solve the problem. What's wrong with Salesforce? We can't get orders through. And if you still sit there and cross your arms and say, my network's healthy, that doesn't help them. So you need tools that can look into your environment with enough depth to say, here's where you're dropping packets. Here's why you're dropping packets, as well as be able to look into those cloud services and say, here's where the cloud infrastructure is dropping packets and why, so that you can go up and say, okay, my internet connection is perfectly healthy right up to Salesforce's edge router, and they're having a route flap, and that's what's causing this problem. Or they've load balanced us to a server that is not responding well. We need to call them up and say, hey, guys, you need to get that server off your load balance scheme because we want to be on a server that's actually working well.
Right. Well, we're running a little low on time. We have about 5 or so minutes left. We wanted to kind of go back to you, and you wanted to actually do a little demo for us, right?
Sure. I can give you a brief overview here. Get the screen up. Perfect. There we go. So completely new user interface. You can set up a custom dashboard to see whatever widgets you want. Most important widget here is obviously the turtle widget. But on the network side, we can look into all your switches, all your routers, see all of this information, click into a switch, see all of the interfaces on the switch. If we want to see what's connected to any of these interfaces, we have all the CDP, LLDP information, so we can see what's physically plugged into these ports. Also, we have all of the bridge table information. So if we want to see what's plugged into a specific port, we say, here's something associated with the HQ voice VLAN. Looks like it's a Dell server. We have an IP address. We can do a reverse DNS lookup. So we have all the information about what connects to each of these interfaces. And you can click in, see utilization, see packet loss, any sort of problems, we're going to be able to disclose that as well. A few other things that we have that are brand new is we have an automatically generated network diagram. And so this is kind of fun because what you can do is drag things around and it's going to end up showing you here's how your network is connected. And any one of these, if you want to lock something into place, you can just move it around and lock it into place. And as your network ends up changing, it's going to automatically add those switches and routers to this diagram. Also, if you want to search for something, you can end up putting in the IP address and say, okay, where is this subnet? And it zooms and pans to find that subnet and square it right in the middle of the screen.
That's neat.
Automatically generated network diagram. So we'll show you, the map to show you, here's the status and utilization of key links and devices in your infrastructure. This updates every 5 seconds so that you know live what's going on in the infrastructure. For cloud services, you can go to the cloud tab. Any one of these cloud services, you want to see what's going on. We're going to track latency, track packet loss. Click into any one of them. You're going to see the route tree at the bottom to say, okay, what's causing our service to our website to be impacted? And we can look at this and say, well, looks like it's this connection here between, it's an AT&T connection, SBC Global. Yeah, they're adding 241 milliseconds between a pair of routers. If we had a bad connection over here, 64 milliseconds of latency, looks like 24 hours ago we had this bad connection here. And who caused it? Okay, well, we don't have reverse DNS on this, but we can at least determine where in that, okay, this is Telia.net, that's probably also Telia.net. So we can determine who caused that problem along the cloud. Because we look into the entire infrastructure, all of the error counters, all of the QoS on every interface of the entire infrastructure, we can do some interesting things. Like if I go to the Issues tab, this is everything that is broken in the network. Interfaces that are dropping packets, buffering packets, interfaces that are misconfigured. You can march through this list and fix everything. And the point here is, if you knew what your equipment knew about what was broken, you'd invest the time to fix it and be able to convert a network that is full of mysteries to a network that is perfectly operating because you now know what the equipment knows. Now, I'm going to share the most embarrassing report on the product, and that's on the Interfaces tab. It's a little sad, but a lot of modern networks still have a bunch of half duplex. The reason is nobody knows where they are. Nobody knows what's going on. But if you deployed and took a look at this and said, yipes, this is pretty bad, maybe we ought to assign the help desk to march through this list, lock everything up to full duplex so that you can proudly say you run a collision-free network. I'm going to finish up on one last thing. This is kind of an interesting report over here. We can predict things that are going to happen on the network. So we have a cabling predictor and a bandwidth predictor. The cabling predictor looks for symbol errors. Now, what a symbol error is that means your Ethernet chipset had to do single bit error correction to fix a physical layer problem before passing a valid frame onto layer 2. If you knew where these chipsets were having to make those fixes, you could take a look at it. And in this case, yeah, you've got a little bit of symbol errors, no big deal. But if, let's say, we had 10,000 symbol errors on this interface, we'd know that that poor chipset has been working like the dickens to try and fix physical layer errors. Now, this is all before you drop a single packet, but if you knew where it was working to fix those problems, you'd be able to go out and say, hey, what's plugged into the Pinot switch interface 19? And you'd find a Cat 3 patch cord and say, well, this needs to be thrown away. You replace it and you fix the problem before a single packet is actually lost. And then the last report is the bandwidth report. This is if your boss came up to you and said, tell me which interfaces in the entire infrastructure are most heavily utilized and are trending towards 100% utilization. And I want you to tell me and predict when will they hit 100% utilization. And so that's what this report will do, is it'll give you a prediction date to say, looks like this one here is our worst interface. November 14th of this year, it's going to hit 100% utilization. So we have a couple of months. No big deal. We can work on this. But if this said 3 days from now, we'd know we'd need to scramble to say, let's get this upgraded to gigabit so that we're not going to have a bandwidth limitation.
This is fantastic, Tim. This is shows how visible you can make your network. And it seems like a really great, useful tool for everyone. So thank you for showing. Appreciate that.
Sure.
So, folks, we've run out of time. You've done it again. You've wasted another hour. It was the best dang enterprise show, according to 9 out of 10 network quality issues. But, of course, I want to thank the panelists for dropping some knowledge on the Twilight Wire. It's episode 300. Thank you, Curtis and Cheeberg. Mr. Curtis, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your works?
Well, you can always find me at darkreading.com. I'm there. Articles pretty much every day. And when I do publish articles there, I always talk about them on Twitter at KG4GWA. Please give me a follow and let me know how I'm doing. And if you're going to be heading to either Black Hat or DEF CON, drop me a direct message. Love to meet up with any members of the Twilight Riot who are going to be out there.
Fantastic. Thank you, Curtis. Of course, thank you to Mr. Brian Chi. Tell the folks on where they can find you and where they can pitch you shows as well as your upcoming projects.
On Twitter, I'm ADVNETLAB, Advanced Network Laboratory, and I'm also Cheebert at twit.tv. I would love to hear from you on show suggestions. Tim, thanks so much for the cake, even though I don't get to go and blow out my blood sugar numbers.
Fantastic. Yeah, obviously we want to thank our guest today, Tim Titus. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you, your work, a little bit about Path Solutions?
www.pathsolutions.com. We do have a demo available. You can also click in and end up seeing a lot of the features and capabilities. Or reach out to us. We do have a show discount, so just mention Twilight and we'll get you that show discount.
Fantastic. Well, thank you, sir, for being here. We really appreciate it. Episode 300, definitely a success. We also want to thank you. You are our loyal listeners. You come in each and every week. You tune in. We want to make it easy for you to listen and watch This Week in Enterprise Tech. So go right now to our show page, twit.tv/Twilight. Find all of our back episodes, the show notes, and all of the stories that we do during each episode. And of course, most importantly, next to that, all the videos there is that subscribe button. Go ahead and subscribe to the format of your choice, as well as whether it's audio, video, HD video, and of course the device of your choice, phone, tablet, laptop, or desktop. And after you subscribe, share the show with your friends. We love doing this show, and if you continue to support us, we can keep doing it. Now, after you subscribe, also remember we do this show each and every week live at live.twit.tv at 1:30 Pacific. And of course, come see how the pizza's made, see how the back, what we do goofy in the back episodes here. And of course, if you're going to be on the show live, you're going to check out the show live, come check our chat room live, irc.twit.tv. You can hear you can actually ask some questions in there. We pull some questions during the live episode. So check it out and come say hi. Also, don't forget to follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. Of course, you can check out all my work that I do at Microsoft at dev.office.com. Of course, I want to make sure I thank everyone who makes the show possible. That's especially to Leo and Lisa, who continue to support This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week. And of course, to our loyal producer, Mr. Brian Cheen. Of course, to all the engineers at Twit. And of course, to our TD this week, Victor. Thank you for filling in and being here and supporting us. We appreciate it.
No problem, man. It was fun.
Yeah, episode 300 was a success because of you, so thank you so much. And of course, and if you want to check my workout, again, check out at dev.office.com and follow me at twitter.com/LouMM. Until next time, I'm Louis Moresca, and if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, Just keep twipe.
300.